Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At this hour, the parents of Terri Schiavo, her husband Michael, and the country wait for a federal judge in Florida to decide whether or not the 41-year-old brain-damaged woman should be put back on a feeding tube. Early this morning, the U.S. Congress stepped into the case, passing emergency legislation for the court's intervention. At 1 a.m. this morning, President Bush signed that bill. A poll out today from ABC shows two-thirds of Americans disapprove of federal intervention in the case and think that Congress overstepped its bounds for political gain. Many conservatives see the Schiavo case as an extension of their anti-abortion agenda. Tonight on Point, the unending case of Terri Schiavo. We begin tonight in Tampa, Florida, where this afternoon U.S. District Judge James D. Whittemore held a two-hour hearing on the case. Tim Padgett is Miami Bureau Chief for Time Magazine and was at the courthouse today. Tim, what's the scene there now? Any word on when there might be a decision from the judge?
No, the judge left it fairly open. He made it plain before the hearing ended that he would not tell them when, where, or how he would rule, and at this point everything's very much in limbo.
Now, we're reading that he pressed Terri Schiavo's parents' attorney, David Gibbs, on whether or not there was a substantial likelihood of a suit succeeding if it went back into the court system.
Right. Well, you have to remember this has been adjudicated, this particular case, more than a dozen times already in various state and federal courts. It's understandable that the latest judge, be it a state or a federal judge, in this case a federal judge, would at this point be wondering, you know, essentially saying to lawyers like Gibbs, what do you have to show me at this point that's going to show me that you have more of a likelihood of succeeding this time around than you did in the past 7 years of rounds of cases before the courts?
And Tim, is there new information that the attorney for Terri Schiavo's parents can bring before this judge or not?
The only sort of new, I don't know, information, but the new tactic, I guess, that was brought out today was this idea that removing Terri Schiavo's feeding tube essentially violates her 14th Amendment rights. One of those rights being they kept insisting to have her religious faith respected. Often the side was arguing that if as a faithful Catholic, if she were to have her feeding tube removed and die in this condition, then she would spend a lot of time in purgatory. There was a lot of canon law as well as constitutional law bandied about in this hearing, and I don't know what sort of effect that would have had on the judge.
Tim Padgett, what are the judge's options? When he comes out with a ruling, is it a simple up or down? What can he propose or what can he command?
Well, his first responsibility is to decide whether or not he's even going to hear this case, whether he's even going to be open to this case. And if he is going to hear the case, then he has to decide, while I'm hearing the case, then do I have the feeding tube reconnected to Terri Schiavo? Because we're working on a very urgent timeline here. After her feeding tube was removed on Friday, she has about a week to 10 days before eventually she dies. So that's his first responsibility. Then if he does decide to hear the case, then he has to decide, are her 14th Amendment rights really being violated? And was it right for the Congress to bring that petition to him in the first place?
It remind us of the passage of this case through the courts already. This has been, in effect, all the way to the Supreme Court when they refused to hear it.
Exactly. This all started back in 1998 when Michael Schiavo, after 8 years after Terri fell into this coma-like state, I shouldn't say coma, it's not the state she's in, a persistent vegetative state is what the doctors call it.
Mm-hmm.
8 years after she fell into the state, he decided that it was time, that he did not see how she could improve at all, and he went to a state court in Florida where these kinds of cases are usually adjudicated in state court, and insisted that Terri had told him before this happened to her that she would never have wanted to live under these conditions. And he successfully petitioned a state judge to have the feeding tube removed. That's when all the appeals on the part of Terri Schiavo's family began, and we've gone now through state and federal courts all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, which last year refused to hear the case, and we've also had the state Florida legislature stepping in with what was called Terry's Law a couple years ago to try to override the state judicial decisions on this. So it's been a very sort of circuitous and bizarre judicial / legislative ride for both sides of this family.
The irony of the feeding tube now being at the center of all this, if we go way back to the beginning, the heart attack that she suffered in 1990 came as a result of an eating disorder. She was not eating enough.
Right. For years, she had had a bulimia-like condition, and that was one of the things that led to the chemical imbalance, which caused a heart attack of sorts, which cut off oxygen temporarily to her brain. And there's always been a point of contention between the two sides of the family, Michael and the Schindlers, Terry Schiavo's parents, as to who was really responsible, if anyone was really responsible, for this eating disorder. It's one of those sort of acrimonious undercurrents in the story.
And any testimony from doctors that Terry Schiavo could, in fact, recover if she were put back on the feeding tube, long-term, mid-term, at any point?
Well, I don't think there are any. There were a couple doctors back in the late 90s who, when it was requested that doctors come in and examine her, I think there was a minority of doctors who said that there was a chance that she could make some sort of improvements, but the level of that improvement was very slight. And I don't think what's at issue really right now is, at least amongst, for example, the Christian right supporters who want to see her kept alive, the issue is really that she's not really in a coma-like state. She's not brain dead. They're making a distinction between brain dead and someone who is, I guess they would say, disabled. They see Terry Schiavo as just disabled because her brain is still functioning in the sense that she's breathing, that her eyes are wandering, etc. And they feel that this is sort of the right to die movement is sort of overstepping its boundaries and putting people who are simply disabled to death rather than people who are truly brain dead and comatose.
Tim Padgett, very briefly, the scene there in Florida tonight. We've seen the vigil around the hospice where Terry Schiavo is now off the feeding tube. What about at the courthouse?
From what I understand, I'm not there right now, but from what I understand, things are fairly quiet. The protests, like last week, have really not been that large or that loud.
Tim Padgett in Tampa, Florida, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Tim Padgett, Miami Bureau Chief for Time Magazine, covering the Terry Schiavo case. We turn now to Washington, where lawmakers are keeping a close watch on developments in Florida. Charles Babington covers Congress for The Washington Post. He joins me now. Charles, thanks for being with us this evening.
My pleasure, Tom.
How do you interpret what happened in the U.S. Congress last night? What are the political currents that came together to produce this extraordinary vote in the middle of the night to intervene in the Terry Schiavo case?
It was an extraordinary scene, very rare type of circumstances here. I think what the main thing that took place, the main currents, are that the pro-life movement, conservative activists in particular, are very, very influential in this Congress. As you know, both houses are controlled by Republicans. Particularly, the House is quite conservative, and they were just they and their allies within the Congress were just very forceful, very outspoken, and in ways that many of the Democrats were reluctant to get too much involved. We're concerned about the political ramifications of this. And so really what you had was that strong pro-life message, if you will, really dominating the debate and therefore dominating the action in both chambers.
Charles, let's pick that apart for a moment. The pro-life movement, what do they see? If a judge should rule that Terry Schiavo must go back on a feeding tube and stay there, what does the pro-life movement feel it would have won here?
Well, yeah, obviously I can't speak for them, but I think they feel that they will have won a great victory, not only on behalf of this one individual, but really, obviously, because this is getting so much national attention, Tom, and here's where is the big debate going on. Bill Frist, the Senate leader, said, well, this is not a precedent. This will apply only to this one case. Other people are saying, you're crazy if you think this won't be a precedent. It absolutely will be a precedent, and which could be problematic. You could have all kinds of appeals from all kinds of, incapacitated people coming to the steps of Congress. So I think, we're getting into some areas that nobody really knows what the ramifications down the road will be.
And what about for the GOP? We've seen the memo that floated around Washington saying there was a great political opportunity here. How are the GOP leaders interpreting the political opportunity in this moment?
Well, in fairness to them, Frist denounced that memo on the Senate floor. And, of course, the Republicans are saying that this is not political opportunism, that this is a principled stand. That's what you'd expect any politician to say. Clearly, some Democrats and other groups are do smell political opportunism in this. But, you know, the really interesting thing, Tom, and you mentioned this a minute ago, is that polls suggest they may not be on the side of the, or suggest they're not on the side of the majority of Americans.
But maybe it's not about lining up with the majority of Americans. I mean, in a political calculus, they've got a conservative Christian right that's been very important to them.
Absolutely. And there's an old adage that an intense, highly committed and organized minority can trump a less intense majority. A perfect example over the years has been gun control. If you do polls, most Americans favor some type of, you know, greater gun control than we have, but you really have an intense minority headed by the NRA that year after year after year can beat back those efforts, and you may have that type of situation here.
70% of those polled in a new ABC poll said that it was not appropriate for Congress to get involved in this. 67% saying it's all about politics, not for out of concern about Schiavo. Briefly, Charles, what about the Democrats in all this?
The Democrats are laying surprisingly low, if you will, if you believe that poll. I think they're somewhat cowed, and maybe with some good reason, because of the intensity of the conservatives. I'll give you a good example of a contrast. The Democrats just still every day, you know, fire away about Social Security. Polls show that Bush's Social Security plan is not that popular. But here, where the polls are even more dramatic, about suggesting that Bush is out of step with the public, they are not firing away, and I think that's because they don't quite know, you know, what the ramifications would be.
Intensity on the pro-life side has had its reward. Charles Babington with The Washington Post, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the Schiavo case and the intervention of the U.S. Congress and the White House. You can join us 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight, along with the rest of the nation, about the Schiavo case and the intervention of the U.S. Congress and White House in the life and death of one woman in a permanent vegetative state. You can join the conversation tonight. Was it right for the U.S. Congress and President Bush to dive in last night on Terri Schiavo's case? Should the feeding tubes stay out, go in? Where do you stand? And are politicians now involved out of principle, out of politics? How do you interpret what's going on in this very emotional case? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. In a moment, we're going to be hearing from Georgia Congressman Phil Gingrey, who's been a strong proponent of intervening on behalf of Terri Schiavo as he sees it. Right now, we're joined from Washington by Representative Barney Frank, a Democratic congressman from Massachusetts. He represents the 4th District there. Congressman Frank, thanks for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
You were very outspoken on the floor of the Congress late last night. What's your view, Congressman, of what's going on here?
That we are making an inappropriate decision. It really is a kind of a constitutional crisis. This is a very difficult decision. Would Terri Schiavo have wanted to live in this situation? Is she in a permanent vegetative state? These are very difficult, very specific situations. Does her husband have her best interest at heart? Now, the courts in Florida, under the American system as it has existed, litigated all of these issues. There were lawyers on all sides. The court appointed neutral representatives to be her guardian. Doctors were appointed, doctors suggested by all sides. Every single doctor that examined this poor woman in this sad condition, and every judge who heard the case or heard an appeal on the case, agreed that she was in a vegetative state and that her husband was correct that she would not have wanted to continue this way. I am in no position to judge that. Neither is anybody else in Congress or in the White House. And what we should have done is have allowed the court system of Florida, which gave this a full hearing, and listen to all the doctors make the decision. Instead, out of a combination of ideological and religious and political feelings, we intervened. We constituted ourselves, over the objection of some of us, as if we were the super Supreme Court of Florida. We overturned the decision of all the courts of Florida, and we decided to send it to a new court with very specific instructions about how it was supposed to be decided. And the separation of powers is not just an abstraction. It wasn't just James Madison on a bad day. There are decisions that politicians ought to make, broad public policy questions for the country, in which you listen to public opinion, in which you take your ideology to it. Then there are specific applications of the law in particular cases where you look at the facts and do a very intensive study. Those go to the courts. What we did last night was to act as if we were a court and to do it without that knowledge, without that information. You raise the question, well, to what extent was it political? To what extent was it legitimate? That's inevitable when politicians decide things. That's why politicians should not be making decisions in individual cases, particularly such sensitive ones.
Well, how do you read the voting profile of Democrats last night in the House? Plenty of Democrats were on board with this.
They were. I would only say of Democrats that we're better than the Republicans. We're far from perfect. I think some people misread, frankly, American public opinion. That is, I will tell you this because I was on the floor all night. A number of people voted for that bill who privately said, well, I don't want to do this, but I'm afraid of the political implications. But that's precisely the point. It would be wrong for members of Congress to get up and say, look, I don't care what anybody else in America thinks. I'm just going to do whatever I think. There's supposed to be some blend of public opinion and our own view. If the court said, well, you know, I got to figure out what the public wants, we'd say, Judge, that's not what you're supposed to do. And the very fact that we don't know to what extent it was a decision on the merits, to what extent it was political, underlines why we shouldn't be doing it. Yeah, there were Democrats who were influenced by the politics of this, and that's not a criticism of them. That's inevitable. Politicians do those things. It is a criticism of putting a decision of this sort into the political branch rather than into the courts of Florida, which did deal with it. It got extensive litigation in Florida.
Barney Frank, so politics are inevitable when politicians are involved, you say.
Oh, I think this...
We got that. And separation of powers, you say there's a constitutional crisis here. But let me ask you to go past that to the drive from the Christian right here. Is there a fundamental ideological battle playing out around this case? And what is it, if there is?
Well, there are two levels. One is, there are some people who said, well, look, if she is in a vegetative state, if she in fact feels nothing, is incapable of thought, never will be, simply breathes, and has indicated that in such a circumstance she would not want to continue to live, then it's okay to discontinue feeding. There are others, many religious people, who say, look, even if you're conscious and say that, we don't honor it. There was an assisted suicide law voted by the voters of Oregon twice in referenda. John Ashcroft tried to cancel that out and override it. There are people who have this religious view that, in their view, life comes from God, and with the exception of capital punishment and war, which are pretty big exceptions, you never, ever interfere with that. And I said yesterday, some of my colleagues could have said, I'm not God, but I play him on C-SPAN.
So when you hear the Republicans saying this is about supporting a culture of life, what's your response, Congressman Frank?
That I'm all for a culture of life. I voted against the war in Iraq. A lot more people were killed in Iraq and are being killed as we speak than in the one case of Terry Schiavo. I believe that we should be doing more to provide medical care for people. Ironically, the Congress that just voted to say we're going to insist that she stay alive, which many felt, just voted to cut the Medicaid program, which is the way you care for many of these people. The question is, in an individual case, who decides? Does their belief for themselves, there are many members of Congress and others who say, look, I never, ever want to be stopped the feeding. I never want the plug pulled. In my case, as long as there's breath, keep it going. That's a decision I honor in their cases. The problem is when they decide to impose that decision for political and ideological and religious reasons in some combination on people who don't agree with them.
Since last November's vote, Barney Frank, we've seen some Democrats looking for a middle ground, as described, on abortion. Does that leave Democrats in a position to oppose this kind of move by the Republicans? Are they now kind of joining the culture of life camp as defined by the right themselves?
Well, a majority of us, not a huge majority of Democrats, voted against it. But, you know, again, the very fact that we are talking about it in these terms is the point I want to stress. These questions you're asking are entirely legitimate political questions that ought to be decided. Why do we take an individual, painful, terribly emotional decision and thrust it into this political maelstrom? That's exactly the point. Yes, it is legitimate to talk about where these issues go. But what right do politicians have to impose on these individuals in this difficult situation that kind of an argument? That's the separation of powers. It's not just an abstraction. It is very real. You can have public policies. Now, there are people who believe, look, no matter what, assisted suicide, if you're conscious or whatever, you never have the right to do that. I think that is an example of imposing your religion on other people. You have a right to practice it yourself. You do not have a right out of a kind of a zeal to impose it on others.
Congressman Barney Frank, Democrat of Massachusetts, joining us tonight from Washington. Congressman Frank, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
We turn now to Atlanta, where we are joined by Phil Gingrey. He's Congressman representing Georgia's 11th District. He's a physician, OBGYN. He spoke as well last night on the House floor as the emergency legislation around the Terri Schiavo case was debated. Congressman Gingrey, thanks for being with us tonight.
Glad to be with you. Thank you.
Give us your interpretation of this case and Congress's action. We just heard from Barney Frank that this has created a constitutional crisis. The separation of powers has been overstepped here by Congress, and Congress is getting its nose in where it shouldn't be. How do you see what's happening here, Congressman?
Well, I don't think we created a constitutional crisis back in the 60s when the federal courts overturned some state court decisions regarding the civil rights of people of color in the Deep South. And I've born and raised in a son of the Deep South, and I'm quite happy today that those decisions were made. I think this clearly is a case where there is a question that an individual, Terri Schiavo's constitutional rights to her most basic right, of course, that is the right to life, has been violated by the state court of the state of Florida. And so this is a very narrowly drawn bill, and it's all about a life and giving her, making sure that her constitutional rights have not been abridged. And if we err, I will err, and I hope we're not in error, but err on the side of life.
Congressman Gingrey, the GOP has been very aggressive in defense of marriage. In this case, Terri Schiavo's husband says she told me that in this circumstance she would not want to be kept alive. Is there a contradiction here?
Well, you know, in some states, Michael Schiavo would be charged with bigamy, living with his girlfriend and fathering two children with her. That's a common law marriage in many states in this country, and he has certainly not shown himself to be a loving, caring husband to the very end. He should have been willing to give up his guardianship, or at least the Florida court should have stripped him of that guardianship when he took up this new life with another woman and began another family. In my opinion, he is not still married to Terri, and if he is, he's guilty of bigamy.
And what about on the side, the GOP here really pushing to keep Terri Schiavo alive? At the same time, President Bush has pushed for an end to malpractice claims. Of course, she's largely supported in no small portion by the results of a malpractice award. Also, the GOP has looked to cut Medicaid. Terri Schiavo is supported by Medicaid. Is there an inconsistency here?
Absolutely not. The president has not, in the Republican leadership, not moved or passed any laws to end malpractice cases, not even by any stretch of the imagination, only to put a limit on non-economic damages known as pain and suffering. But we, as a physician member, and there are 10 of us in the Congress, in the House, two in the Senate, I fully believe that people who have been injured need to have an opportunity to redress their grievances. And in many cases, the awards are in the millions of dollars, but we only limited the so-called pain and suffering awards. So that's a mischaracterization to say that we tried to end medical malpractice cases.
And on the Medicaid side, sir?
Well, Medicaid is a very expensive program, as Medicare is, and we need to make sure that we will get rid of all waste, fraud, and abuse in those programs, and to ask them to cut some of the waste out of the program, $60 billion over 5 years, so about, what, $12 billion a year. I think we can do that. I think the states can do that. You know, they've been gaming this system for a long time. Many states have really abused the system where the federal government, in some instances, paying up to almost 70, in fact, almost 80%, and the state matches just a little more than 20. We have to make sure that there's oversight and due diligence, and I think we'll be able to find those savings without sacrificing the needy who have to have that program.
And Phil Gingrey, you're a congressman. You're also a doctor. The court-appointed doctors in this case have found that Terri Schiavo is in a persistent vegetative state from which she's unlikely, almost certainly, to recover. Can you imagine a case, as a doctor, in which you would say, yes, this is a time to withdraw the feeding tube, to withdraw life support, or are you always committed, in all cases, to keeping the tube in?
No, absolutely not. If a person has in writing a advance directive or a living will, as it's known, and there is in that first and foremost, you would abide by their wishes. And if there's any question of that, if it's a matter of a verbal living will, then you would certainly want all parties, the family, to not be in dispute. As they are in this case. And I think it's very, very unlikely that Terri would have even verbalized that at age 27 as a very young married woman. It's very hard to believe that. This is a very unusual case. That's why it's narrowly drawn, applicable only to Terri. It's not setting a precedent and certainly not creating a constitutional crisis, as my good friend from Massachusetts, Representative Frank, has suggested.
Congressman Phil Gingrey in Atlanta tonight, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. I was happy to be with you.
Congressman Phil Gingrey represents Georgia's 11th district and was a strong supporter last night of the legislation that went through, getting the courts involved again in the case of Terri Schiavo. Joining me now from Philadelphia is Nate Persily. He's professor of law and political science at the University of Pennsylvania. Hope he'll give us some perspective on what's going on here. Nate Persily, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me back.
We're hearing such diverse views of what is unfolding here. You've got people saying this is an absolutely vital case to life itself, to the culture of life, to the dignity of life in the United States, and others saying, Barney Frank, just now, we've got a constitutional crisis here, separation of powers being breached, a kind of a system meltdown. How do you see, as a professor of law, what's going on here, Nate?
Well, I don't see this as a constitutional crisis. It's an interesting constitutional case because it is unprecedented. You have Congress really trying to reopen a case which a state court has decided. I don't think it's quite clearly unconstitutional, but it's you know, certainly walking in new snow. I mean, fundamentally, this is a question about who will be able to decide, and it brings in all these questions of separation of powers and federalism. I mean, the question is, should the state or the federal government decide this? And beyond that, should the courts or should the Congress be the active player here? And I think that, you know, they're doing something unprecedented.
Well, 19 judges in 6 courts in the 15 years since she had the heart attack that cut her oxygen off and left her in the state. 19 judges have said, have ruled the other way, have ruled Michael Schiavo's way. So doesn't I don't know, what does create an offense of the separation of powers if it's not Congress responding to 19 judges?
Well, but what they're saying is that these state courts have not been in a position to vindicate the federal constitutional rights of Terri Schiavo. And so what they're saying is that the federal court will now adjudicate whether her right to life, not to be deprived of life without due process of law, has been violated, and so the parents are going to have standing to come in this particular case and make those arguments. I want to be clear, because I think there's been a lot of misinformation on this, that Congress has not overturned the state court judgment. They have given the federal court basically the power to do that, and it's going to be very difficult for them to win in federal court to prove that her constitutional rights have been violated. I mean, I think the merits of this case are still an uphill battle for the parents of Terri Schiavo.
But you say it's pushing it into the federal courts. Of course it is here, but it has always been under the U.S. Constitution, in the sense that the state court operates under that Constitution. The Supreme Court looked at this and took a pass on intervening. That's a kind of a judgment in itself. I mean, hasn't the U.S. Constitution always been in play here in this case?
Well, certain arguments the Schiavos are going to have said in their complaint today have not really been made. The best analogy to this is a collateral attack on a death penalty judgment, so that, you know, we have death penalties that go through the state court, and then we have a federal statute dealing with habeas corpus that allows for these collateral attacks in federal court. Now, that really, now those, that piece of legislation is generally applicable. It's not after the fact, and it's not, you know, targeted toward a particular case, and so it's very different than what we have here. But that is the special case of where you have a federal court reviewing a state court judgment. I don't want to underplay the special nature of this law. It really is unprecedented, but it's not on its face unconstitutional. I think ultimately, though, that it's probably going to be sound and fury signifying very little, because they're not going to win on the constitutional claims.
But they will have set a precedent of intervening. They say it's not a precedent because it's narrowly drawn. Do you agree there's no precedent set here?
Well, no, the problem is it is a precedent because it is narrowly drawn. I mean, the fact that you're going to, in effect, create a legislative precedent for private bills like this now suggests that Congress is going to be looking over the shoulders of state court judges and
walking in new snow. Nate Persley, stand by for a moment. We've got to take a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at the Schiavo case at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about the Schiavo case and the intervention of the U.S. Congress and White House in the life and death of one woman, a woman in a permanent vegetative state in Florida. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Would you want the U.S. Congress in your family's own life and death decisions, in your wife's, in your daughter's? What are the politics playing out here? Does one party own the culture of life? And what does this whole debate say about the state of the nation's politics and culture today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight from Philadelphia by Nate Persley, professor of law and political science at the University of Pennsylvania. We're joined right now from Charlottesville, Virginia, by Larry Sabato, director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Larry Sabato, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Larry, how do you interpret the politics here? What do we see that's playing out? Is this an extension of the battle around the presidential campaign last fall? How do you analyze what's happening here in political terms?
Well, politically, it's pretty obvious that the Republicans believe, even though a majority of the public probably believes that the Congress should not be involved in this, that the actual voters, the people who will vote on this issue, are tilted toward the Republican side. And they're actually right, in my view. Most people will forget about this controversy a month or so after it's over, if not sooner than that. But the people who will vote on the issue are overwhelmingly conservative Christians who believe that this is a key pro-life issue.
So you say it's been proven at the polls, and you expect it will be proven again, that this constituency merits this attention.
It merits that attention from the Republican side because they're such a fundamental part of the GOP voter base.
And what happens in a country when one group like this, substantial as it is, still a minority, begins driving national policy with this prominence?
Well, and this, we can see the results in this particular case. This is an individual case, but of course the ramifications are much larger than the one individual. So it's significant, and whether you support or do not support the actions of the Congress this weekend, it's pretty extraordinary for Congress to take this kind of emergency action for one citizen.
The overall polling today from ABC shows 63% of Americans favor the removal of the feeding tube. What's already happened, what the courts have already ordered, 28% oppose. And even among evangelical Protestants, 46% in favor of removing the tube, 44% oppose. So even there among evangelicals, among non-evangelical Protestants, 77% of the feeding tube being removed, staying out. I mean, there's a huge division between evangelical and mainline Protestants, and even among evangelicals, a minority supporting this. But the sway is there anyway.
Yeah, it's, again, you have to remember that polls, first of all, are deceptive for lots of reasons. They don't clearly explain who votes and why they vote. And the people who are going to vote on this issue are just overwhelmingly in favor of what Congress did.
So how big a celebration among Republicans tonight? Is this a boost for their midterm election prospects next year? Is this just more money in the bank? Is it payback for the presidential win? How do you think they're looking at this?
I suppose it is money in the bank, but it's mainly votes in the bank. It reaffirms the ties that have existed for some time between conservative religionists and the Republican Party. And you just can't understate the importance of this relationship in most of those red states, certainly the southern states, the border states, some of the rural Midwestern states, and a few of the Rocky Mountain states. It's really critical, and turnout, especially in midterm elections, which we're about to have in 2006, is way down from the presidential level. So voter motivation is critical in determining voter turnout, which in turn determines who wins.
So big prizes here. Larry Sabatow, Nate Persley, please stand by. I want to begin to bring our callers in. Robert's calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hello, Robert. You're on the air.
Terrific show. I wanted to provide a counterpoint to the Chavez story. On March 15th, CNN reported that a five-month-old Texas infant named Sun Hudson died after doctors removed him from a ventilator over the objections of his mother. Now, the doctors did this pursuant to a 1999 Texas statute that allows doctors to terminate treatment if they deem it to be medically futile, even over the objections of the family.
1999 Texas statute, that would have been signed by George W. Bush.
George W. Bush, that's correct. He signed the statute into law. So when George Bush says that he thinks there should be a presumption in favor of life, you have to wonder what he was thinking when he signed this statute into law, which is much more aggressive than the Florida approach, certainly.
Robert, we've got it, and thanks for raising it. Nate Persley, are you aware of the Texas statute? Do we have the president working it one way in Texas and the other nationally? Is it a kind of legal evolution of this issue underway here?
No, I don't think he's necessarily been inconsistent. I'm familiar with the case. I'm not familiar with the statute. But as I understand what happened in Texas, it's a little more complicated than that. But, you know, as Barney Frank and some of your other previous commentators mm-hmm. have explained, you know, when we talk about a culture of life, it's in a specific context when tying it to the Republican Party platform. And we're talking in particular about a lot of these moral values issues dealing with abortion and dealing with assisted suicide or in this case euthanasia. Obviously, it doesn't extend to the death penalty or all types of other issues dealing with the protection of life, or for that matter, free medical care, or some of the other things that Barney Frank was more in favor of.
But Nate Persley, when you look at the trend that Larry Sabatow is describing, that this minority that votes, especially when it's revved up around an issue like this, is so potent in the electoral system, how does that begin to filter over onto the judicial side here? Do sitting judges begin to tailor their decisions toward the knowledge that this group is sitting out there ready to push back, or is it a matter of waiting for new judges to be put into the courts? I mean, do we end up with a changed court system, changed interpretation of the Constitution?
Well, one hopes not. The courts are not supposed to be following public opinion polls in the same way that maybe congressmen are. Let me say two things. First of all, I think you will be surprised by how some of the more conservative justices on the Supreme Court vote in these types of cases. For example, Justice Scalia, seen as maybe the most conservative on the Supreme Court, has said that the federal court should stay completely out of this mess of dealing with the so-called right to die. That this is something, he said, that nine people taken off the street would be just as qualified to decide as the nine Supreme Court justices. Mm. So he has said, you know, the federal court should stay out of it. I think that it does, however, when fit in the larger picture of federal Supreme Court and lower court appointments, fit into a program of allowing certain values to have their place in the judicial system. So that, yes, I think this might be of similar salience to the abortion issue when you have, say, a confirmation fight over a judge who has dealt with a Terry Schiavo-like case.
And you've got the needle moving here. Mary's calling from DeForest, Wisconsin. Hello, Mary, you're on the air.
Well, hello. The Judicial Department in our country, that branch does not have the right to make any kind of laws at all. They are supposed to interpret the laws of the Congress, for instance. The Congress has the authority over them, really, and they should have impeached some of them through the years more than they have.
What about the Constitution and the separation of powers, Mary? I mean, the judges are supposed to stand on their own 2 feet as well, right?
There is such a thing, but I understand that the Congress has the right to impeach, for instance, federal judges, those in the Supreme Court. And let's just say that it also, they are doing what they should do. They're not abdicating their responsibility here.
So you're glad they're stepping up in this case?
Oh, definitely. And her life is very precious. I feel, and I have felt for a long time now, that some group of people, more than one maybe, but primarily one, I think, want her dead.
And you're
they
talking
murdered.
You're saying the husband, and there's one interpretation from Wisconsin. We've got it, Mary. We hear you. Larry Sabatow, you know this pushback against the direction of the courts and the court system in recent decades. Is it coming to some kind of head here? Do you feel even a kind of shift in the relative power of the legislative and executive and judicial branches underway here?
Well, this is a great controversy. It has been, of course, for decades. Those who are strict constructionists believe, and have believed for a long time, that the judiciary is going well beyond their function of interpreting the Constitution, interpreting the laws, and in fact, as Mary was suggesting, making the law. Now, others say that the judiciary is simply stepping in and fulfilling a need created by inaction on the part of the legislative branch and the executive branch. And so it depends on your philosophy and your ideology. I might want to mention one other point. Hypocrisy is the lifeblood of politics, and the lifeblood is flowing on both sides of the aisle. Both parties are guilty of it. But I am surprised that so many Republicans are switching positions on federalism here.
That is, states' rights.
Yeah. Normally, this would be an issue, or a similar issue would be suggested by the Republican side, that the state courts should handle this, that the states should be the arbiter of these very personal questions. And yet, in this case, we do see the intervention of the federal Congress.
We heard Congressman Phil Gingrey from Georgia saying earlier in the hour that there's precedent for this kind of intervention, that Congress, Washington intervened in the state's business in the 60s, in the civil rights era. An interesting precedent for the Georgia congressman to raise.
Can I add one thing on that?
Yes,
which
Nate.
Is that this is true across a range of areas in American public policy today, I mean, in the last 5 years, so that when it comes to social policy versus federalism, I think that for the most part, social policy is winning out, so that it's not just this particular case. I mean, you look at, for example, the partial birth abortion ban passed at the federal level is the Republicans have been talking about it as being a state's decision to make with respect to abortion rules, and that's trying to be federalized. Obviously, the federal marriage amendment is trying to take away from states a certain amount of prerogative with respect to how they're going to define their marriage rules. Also, this is not the first area with respect to the right to die. The Justice Department has been seeking to overturn the Oregon's Death with Dignity Act and prosecute doctors under that, as well as, of course, to overturn the legalization of medical marijuana in California. I mean, these are all issues of social policy which have been either legislated or executed at the federal level in the last 5 years, which previously might have been seen as issues of states' rights.
We've got a lot more callers here. Larry Sabatow, I know I have to let you go. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
I enjoyed it very much. Good discussion.
Larry Sabatow from Charlottesville, Virginia, director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Kay is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Kay. You're on the air.
Hi. I think it's really ironic. I had a child with severe disabilities.
Your own child, Kay? Your own child?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Matthew died a number of years ago. He did have a feeding tube, but we used massive amounts of Medicaid funding to cope and survive. And I think it's really important for society to look at that's a big part of the reason why Medicaid costs are growing, because science can save people or use heroic measures. Years ago, there was no such thing as feeding tubes or as high-priced ventilators. And, you know, I think that there's larger issues, as well as a parent, I would never want to willingly let my child die. But I think also I really believe that the husband, as the one who was closest to her...
Her chosen companion in life.
Well, she was. They weren't separated. They weren't divorced. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't living with her parents.
Kay, may I ask you, you've
yes.
been through this, and you know the pain of it directly, yes. but I hear you suggesting that the abundance of Medicaid that's there in a way may drive people to choose the sustaining of life long past the time they would otherwise, yet it helps sustain your own child.
It at least makes it an option, because so many of the little premature babies, my son was 2 pounds, 2 ounces,
mm-hmm.
the way they survive is with all kinds of therapy and all kinds of, intensive care things. And her big insurance settlement, apparently, and Medicaid is what has been paying for 15 years of Terry's costs. And
it's a big bill stacking up there, and we see...
At a time when they're cutting it in Congress.
Right, we see exactly how you're looking at it. Kay, thanks very much for your call. I want to get one more call on. David's calling from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Hello, David, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
One of your previous guests mentioned how, in a way, this is similar to death penalty cases, and I just wanted to point out in a way in which it's very different, and that is that Congress has done a lot over the last decade to eviscerate federal courts' power to review death penalty cases
mm-hmm.
in the state courts.
To bind them so that they're not getting in the way of the execution.
Right. And again, in this name of federalism and of finality of judgments of state courts, that anything that, I mean, that basically state court decisions should be final. And I know, hypocrisy is normal in politics, but the idea that the Republicans are going to represent that they are the party of life when then-Governor Bush presided over more executions than any other governor in modern history.
Culture of life, but not omnidirectional here. David, thanks very much for your call. Nate Persley, we've just got a minute left this evening. As you sit back and watch this, do you see American judicial culture being changed here, or are justices going to say, no, we're going to go on our way here? Thank you, Congress. We don't really want you intervening this way.
Well, I don't think that this is as significant as if they were starting to impeach judges in a grand kind of scale. The thing, I think the sort of shot across the bow is across the bow of state courts. That was true, I should say, both with Bush versus Gore, which was a federal review of a state court judgment, and it's true here too, which is that, all right, people are watching what state courts are doing, and the Congress will flex its muscle, that federalism won't get in the way.
And finally, Nate, if the federal judge in Florida does not decide to intervene and have the tube withdrawn, is that it? Or is there another appeal that could be made here?
No, there will be an appeal to the 11th Circuit and then potentially to the U.S. Supreme Court. And frankly, what I see this legislation is about is it's mainly symbolic legislation to try in the interim, as there's federal litigation going on, to have the feeding tube reinserted.
Nate Persley at University of Pennsylvania Law School, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me again.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.